Yeah. So thanks for the invitation. It's great to be back here, as always. I was just thinking, actually, every time I'm in this room, you know, conductors sometimes will conduct from the piano when they're playing a concerto. And I've always really been tempted to give a seminar from the piano in this room. But I decided it probably wouldn't be a good idea today, so I won't attempt it. Indeed, I'm going to talk about a set of three things which don't seem particularly related the first time you think about it, probably. Wormholes, emergent gauge fields, and the weak gravity conjecture. My goal for the talk is to convince you that they are related, and in a way which at least I think is interesting. So let's start by first remembering a set of popular conjectures about what happens when you have electromagnetism coupled to gravity. From the point of view of perturbative, low-energy effective field theory, there's nothing wrong with just having a Maxwell field coupled to a gravity and nothing else. You know, that's a consistent perturbative expansion. But nonetheless, many people, probably most people in this room, believe that that's not consistent. And here are three conjectures of increasing strength that sharpen why that can't be consistent. So the weakest conjecture is that if you have a U1 gauge field, there need to be states or objects that are charged under the gauge field. Doesn't have to be true in perturbation theory, but the claim is the consistency of quantum gravity somehow demands it. A stronger version of this conjecture is that there exists all charges, where what I mean by that is that the gauge group G could be U1, let's say G. It has some the topology of the gauge group gives some allowed lattice of charges. And the claim is that every single charge in the lattice there must be a state that actually has that charge. Okay, so that's stronger than the first. That's going to be conjecture number three. Yeah. So conjecture number three is not only are conjectures one and two true, but something called the weak gravity conjecture is true. And I'm going to define the weak gravity conjecture as follows. So, and for the rest of the talk, I'm just going to discuss U1. So G will just be U1. So then, say that the charge is allowed by charge quantization are all multiples of some fundamental charge Q. So here N is an integer. There exists an object, let's say, with charge n equals 1. So there exists an object of minimal charge. So far that's implied by number 2. But moreover, the mass of that object times the square root of g Newton has to be less than or equal to q, where there's some order 1 constant here that I'm not going to try and fix because I'm not going to be able to reproduce it anyway. I should emphasize that conjectures number 1 and 2 could be satisfied just by black holes. You could say there are black holes of various charges. You could have black holes of all charges. So those can satisfy 1 and 2. But 3 can't be satisfied by black holes in general. So say, for example, so because this Q is the gauge coupling, okay? This is just the thing that controls the quality of the perturbative expansion in the gauge interactions. So in particular, This is saying that m in Planck units must be less than or equal to q. So if the coupling is weak, if q is much less than 1, then the object which is required by conjecture number 3 is a particle. You know, it has a small entropy, and it's something that you would have to include in the Lagrangian, right, in the effective Lagrangian below the Planck scale. So this is really constraining effective field theory below the Planck scale in a way that these two aren't maybe necessarily. Okay, this. Absolutely. So each of these conjectures applies the previous one. Yeah, that's right. Implies the previous one. So yeah, these are of increasing strength.
Extremal black holes would saturate that.
So an extremal black hole of charge 1, I wouldn't call a black hole because its entropy is small. Its mass is less than the Planck scale. Well, that's true, it is, but I mean, I would say it's something you have to include in the Lagrangian. I mean, yeah, so there is a meaningful distinction there. I mean, what we call it, I don't know, is an electron a black hole? I mean, I guess a black hole is a particle, but I don't think an electron is a black hole.
Well, sorry, you never have to have anything stronger than the equality, right? You could have basically quantum extremal black hole, and that could be your particle satisfying this, and that's all.
Well, I guess you can call it a black hole if you want. I would say, you know, say Q is 10 to the minus 10, right? I mean, then this is a particle whose mass is 10 to the minus 10 in Planck units. Now, if you want to call it a black hole, I suppose I can't stop you. But I wouldn't. Yeah.
But it's important that you include the equal sign.
Yeah, it's important that you include the equal sign. Otherwise, they're counterexamples. Yeah, and actually in string theory there are examples where, you know, you have things that are like this when the charge is small, and then they families of BPS states which become black holes when the charge gets larger. Yeah. So far I should say that really the only arguments that I consider to be good arguments for these three conjectures are all of the form, they happen to be true in string theory. And you know, I mean, I don't really have a problem with that. I mean, that's probably a good argument. But
the first two, you said, are satisfied with black holes.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So right. I mean, well, this one I'm not sure, right? I mean, yeah, I guess you could say that they exist somehow as classical solutions. I mean, even that, I mean, you have to make them out of something, right? So. Yeah, that's right. No, if you have electrons, of course. Yeah. Yeah, electrons are sufficient to satisfy. Yeah. So I mean, right. In that sense, probably the third one is the one where the argument that it's true in string theory is probably, you know, the. I want to be very clear that the fact that the wormhole exists with flux going through it, I do not consider to be evidence for either one or two. And we'll see an example later in the talk where such a thing exists, but there are definitely no charges. So that's going to be very important in what follows. So I think if you want to argue this from black holes, the argument that I consider to be good, well, no, actually, I don't think you can argue without using something like ADS-CFT. That's roughly what I'm going to argue in ADS-CFT, but you need to have some sort of charged particles in order to have that. I mean, just from the point of view of low energy effective field theory, I mean, I think it you could just. Yeah, but the flux, there's never any charge, the electric flux never ends on a thing, right? It goes through the wormhole and comes out the other side and goes off to infinity. I mean, by charges, I mean things that the flux ends on. Yeah, if you like. Yeah.
Uh,
Oh yeah, maybe you could have something like that. Yeah, that one I might have to concede is a charged particle. Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah.
With the wormhole, you can produce a pair connected by a wormhole, and then you can take one off to infinity, basically a cluster.
No, but the electric flux is still going through the wormhole. So okay, I this is semantics, so I don't want to get. I'm going to say something precise. So let's just maybe we can have this discussion again after we see what the new arguments are.
So when you say there's some Ottawa coefficient in that inequality, you meant specifically the kind of Ottawa coefficient that you can write down where the extremal black holes.
Yeah. The coefficient is chosen so that an extremal black hole saturates this. That's right. That's how you pick the coefficient. Yeah. Okay. So my goal today is to present a paradox in ADS-CFT whose resolution seems to require all three of these conjectures to be true. Okay. Now, I'm going to use ADS-CFT as input. So you might say that morally that's not much better than saying, oh, it happens to be true in string theory. But I guess I can somehow, ADS-CFT feels more non-perturbative and complete to me. And so I feel happier about an argument that is based on ADS-CFT. So let's first recall that in the vicinity of the vacuum, when you have gauge fields in ADS-CFT, we can reconstruct the gauge fields in the CFT. So we can reconstruct operators made out of the gauge field in the bulk in terms of the current in the CFT, which is dual to the gauge field. So here are a few examples of the kinds of operators. You could have a Wilson loop, a closed Wilson loop. You could have a Wilson loop that starts at the boundary and ends at the boundary. Since we're doing U1, you could have F mu nu. You could just have the electric field or the magnetic field sitting there. Those are all gauge invariant operators in the bulk. And we know how to make all of them out of the dual current in the CFT using the methods that have been being discussed all week. This story gets more interesting, though, if we consider not the vicinity of the vacuum, but the vicinity of the thermal field double. So there are still these kinds of things. You know, you can have a Wilson line that does that, or a Wilson loop. You can have an electric field. But now there's a new kind of thing that you didn't have in this example, which is you can have a Wilson line that starts at this boundary, goes through the wormhole, and ends at that boundary. That's a gauge invariant operator. And this operator can't be written in terms of J mu using the methods that you use in the vicinity of the vacuum. I won't go through the details of why not, but roughly the idea is that, well, the interesting thing about a Wilson line is if you cut it, for example, in the center, you just say, oh, I'm gonna split it into the left part and the right part. Well, the parts aren't separately gauge invariant. Whereas anything that, you know, so if I try to make the left part of it here by using the current, well, anything I make out of the current, it's going to be gauge invariant by definition, because any operator in the CFTs is always gauge invariant. So if I'm going to be able to make this Wilson line, I'm going to have to do it in some way other than just combining J mu left and J mu right in the usual way. This actually reflects a more general problem, which is, I guess, is going to be the subject of another one of the It from Qubit workshops, which is that when you have a gauge theory, it's not so easy to assign tensor factors to spatial regions. And it's exactly because of this. You know, there are Wilson lines that are cut by your entangling surface. And so they prevent you from having a gauge invariant tensor factorization of the Hilbert space into, say, inside and outside of some region. Now, from the point of view of ADS-CFT, that's kind of surprising, though, because this system, right, we know what the microscopic Hilbert space of this is. And it does tensor factorize. It's the left CFT times the right CFT. So that means that if this Wilson line operator exists, we're somehow going to have to be able to cut it, because any operator on a tensor product Hilbert space can be written as a sum of products of operators on the two sides separately. And those two cited separately operators have to be gauge invariant, because again, every operator on the CFTs on either one is gauge invariant. So how can this be consistent with the Wilson line? How is the CFT cutting the Wilson line? It must be in some non-trivial way. I call this question, how do we cut the Wilson line? I call it the factorization problem. The factorization problem. You know, roughly, the bulk Hilbert space, naively, of the gauge field doesn't factorize, but the microscopic CFT Hilbert space does factorize. So most of the rest of this talk will be building up a proposal for how to resolve the factorization problem. And I should just emphasize, I'm not going to argue that it's the only possible resolution. It's going to be a resolution. But I think the features are pretty general, and I guess any other resolution wouldn't be too different. Now, one ingredient of the resolution we can actually we can immediately derive from things that are already on the blackboard. So let's call this Wilson line W, and let's say it's in representation n of U1. So Wilson lines come in representations, e to the in times the integral of A. Simple homework problem. You can show that the commutator of the Wilson line with the difference of the charge operators in the right and left CFTs, so these are just integral of J0 over the right and left boundaries respectively, or alternatively integrals over the electric flux over the two boundaries, is equal to 2n times wn. Okay, so this is saying that this Wilson line operator is a creation operator for q right minus q left, or an annihilation operator, I guess, depending on signs, which I won't try and get right on the fly. So in particular, if you look in the thermal field double state at the expectation value of this quantity, or I guess the right way to say it is we take the thermal field double state, we act with W, and we look at the expectation value of Q left minus Q right, this is equal to 2n. And in particular, it's not equal to 0 if n is not equal to 0. So this immediately tells us, because we know that the Hilbert space is factorized, that Q, as a CFT operator, is not equal to 0. Okay? So I think that's a pretty general argument. Hard to get around it. I think that deals with conjecture number one. There must be charged states. I think this is a much simpler argument than the usual arguments. Although it does take ADS CFT as input. Now, to deal with conjectures two and three, we're going to have to build up some more machinery. Interesting. Let's see. Okay. I'm now going to start by discussing the factorization problem in gauge theories in more detail. So this sort of concludes the introduction. So are there any questions at this point? All right. So now we're going to discuss the Hilbert space of gauge theories. So the factorization problem is most clear in gauge theories if we just look at pure QED. So let's look at pure QED. On a spatial cylinder, so R times S2. So that's some spatial slice like that. There's the interesting fact that, so let's pick two of the two spheres at different points along the line. So let's say this one is S and this one is S prime. So then by integrating the Gauss constraint in between the two spheres, we have the equation that the integral over S of E dot A is equal to the integral over S prime of E dot dA as an operator equation. This is an equation that is true on all physical states, all gauge invariant states. Now, if you think about it from the point of view of quantum field theory, that seems a little bit weird, right? It's saying that I have an operator over here and an operator over there, and they're macroscopically separated, but they're equal to each other in all states. So in particular, that could not be true if I could associate a tensor factor, say, to this shaded region containing the first sphere and this shaded region containing the second sphere. Because could I do that? Were there a factorization of the Hilbert space where I could write this as some tensor factor here times some tensor factor there? Well, the only operator that can be equal, you know, with this one acting on this tensor factor and this one acting on that tensor factor, is if they're both trivial, if they're both proportional to the identity. That's the only operator in common between two tensor factors. Whereas it's easy to see that this operator is non-trivial, okay? Because I can act with this Wilson line. So this is just the electric flux down the cylinder, and I can create it by acting with the Wilson line. Now, there's a slight parenthesis there, which is that I have to choose boundary conditions at the end so that I'm allowed to act with the Wilson line, so I'll do that. And those are the same boundary conditions you choose in ADS-CFT. In fact, this topology is the same as the topology of that, and that's not a coincidence. That's, of course, why I picked it. Pure Maxwell theory, no matter.
No electrons.
No electrons. That's what I meant by pure. Yeah. Clearly this is going to not be true, and we're about to get to that. Okay. Now, indeed, we already saw that we aren't allowed to consider pure Maxwell theory in this example because there are charges. And moreover, it's clear that once you include charges, then there's something on the right-hand side of Gauss's law. So when you integrate it, you no longer get this. You get that these are equal plus the integral of the charge density in between them, and that's not in general zero.
So the only input of ADS-CFT up there really was stating that the Hilbert space factor.
That's correct. That's correct.
Also that the Wilson line doesn't annihilate the Hilbert
space. That's right. Yeah. Which is a statement about the boundary conditions. So, indeed, what this Wilson line does here is it makes the wormhole a little bit Reisner-Nordström. It just creates a little bit of electric flux going through the wormhole, and I guess we think that should be allowed. I mean, if there's a gauge field in the bulk and it's allowed by the boundary conditions, which it is for the standard quantization of a Maxwell field in ADS, you have to be allowed to do it. Okay. So now, once I include charges, I can't give you as simple of an argument as this. I instead have to go to the lattice. So I apologize, we're now going to go to the lattice. To make life simple, though, I'm just going to do it in 1+1 dimensions. So I'm going to collapse the two-sphere to a point and just discuss U1 lattice gauge theory on a line. And let's say somewhere in the middle here I have I and I plus 1. Okay, so I have n total lattice sites arranged in a line. So then the degrees of freedom are that on each link I have an element of the gauge group, ui plus 1. And then, since the whole point was to include charges, I'm also going to have a complex scalar field, phi I, living on each site. Okay. So then the gauge transformations of these guys are that phi prime I is equal to vi phi I, where vi is e to the I lambda at site I. And then u prime I plus 1 is vi plus 1 ui I plus 1 vi dagger. So this is like the infinitesimal Wilson link gauge transformation. Finally, I have to tell you the boundary conditions, which will be that v0 equals vn. So the gauge transformation at the edges have to be trivial. And just for the hell of it, we'll put Dirichlet boundary conditions on the scalar, zero. So this is now a well-defined Hamiltonian system. Let's look at some of the gauge invariant operators. And I'm sorry for giving these details, but it'll be very important to keep all of this in mind going forward. So, okay, so my favorite gauge invariant operator, the one we've been discussing so far, is the Wilson line that starts here and goes there. And it's going to be gauge invariant because of these boundary conditions. So that's just u0, 1, un minus 1, n, just the product of all the u's going down the line. There'll be electric field operators also living on the links, which are roughly the canonical conjugates of u. Okay. And then phi by itself is not gauge invariant, but we can make it gauge invariant by adding a Wilson line, as was discussed earlier in the week already at the workshop. And interestingly, we can run the Wilson line either way, right? We can run it to the right or we can run it to the left. So there will be an operator phi right, which is phi I, ui, I plus 1, un minus 1, n. So that's running the Wilson line to the right. And then there's an operator phi left, which is u0, 1, dagger, ui minus 1, I, dagger, phi I. And those are both gauge invariant operators. And then finally, there's the current density at site I, rho I, which is d d phi I, phi I, minus d d phi I dagger, phi I dagger. So then the generator of gauge transformations, the constraint, or if you like, the Gauss law, is ei I plus 1 minus ei minus 1 I equals rho I. So this is 0 on all states. That's the discrete version of Gauss's law. Now, why did I go to the trouble of defining all of this? Well, the reason is because the nice thing about 1 plus 1 dimensions is I can solve the constraint explicitly, and I can just give you the functional form of any gauge invariant state. That's a little bit harder to do in higher dimensions. So indeed, if we solve the constraint, so that means I'm going to write down the wave function, phi, so that's the of a gauge invariant state psi, onto the gauge and charge degrees of freedom, it always is going to have the following form. So it'll be a functional of the Wilson line W, and then it'll be a function of the phis. Now we could, in fact, just pick it to be phi right and phi right dagger, and that's a general solution. But instead, I'm going to do something slightly more complicated. I'm going to take it to be phi right and phi right dagger for I greater than or equal to L plus 1. And then I'll take it to be phi left I and phi left dagger for I less than or equal to L. Okay, where I just picked some L somewhere in the center of the lattice and I made a cut there. And then everything to the left, I dress to the left. And everything to the right, I dress to the right. So W is like the dressing switching operator, if you like. By using W, I can switch the dressing from one direction to the other. So then that I can use that to, say, send them all to the right or send them all to the left. Now, why did I go to the trouble here? Because what this shows is that the Hilbert space still doesn't factorize. So it almost does. I've got all these guys going to the right. And these guys commute with W. That they commute with all the electric fields on the left, and these guys commute with all the electric fields on the right. So it almost factorizes, but not quite, because we've got the extra Wilson line sitting there. Now, if I want it to be fancy, there's a beautiful reformulation of this condition of whether you do or don't factorize algebraically in terms of whether the operator algebra associated to a region has a non-trivial center. So here you can prove that, and also in the previous case, that indeed it has a non-trivial center, and therefore there's no factorization is possible. But I don't want to go through the details of that. Looks like we still don't factorize even after we included the charges. But I had to work harder to show that to you. I had to go to the lattice, and that should make you a little suspicious. You know, if we're really talking about some general property of the theory here, I shouldn't have to go to the lattice to convince you of it. And indeed, that's a correct lesson, which is that once charges are included, the question of whether or not the Hilbert space factorizes becomes a UV-sensitive question. That was previously not true. Without the charges, right, I just gave you some IR, you know, large separation proof that it doesn't factorize. But now I had to go to the lattice. Yeah?
Let me just ask, one thing, the Hilbert space that doesn't factorize as a tensor product, the example that comes to mind to me is a TQFT. Is that a good example, Peter?
Yeah, actually, good. So, yeah, let me comment on that. So now in this discussion, let's just briefly throw out all the charges again. Then all I'm left with now is the Wilson line. I have a quantum field theory where the gauge invariant Hilbert space is just that of a particle on a circle. So essentially, it's a topological field theory. Now, that's not quite true. I think it's gauge invariant under area preserving diffeomorphisms is the correct statement, but it's almost a topological field theory. Yeah. And there is indeed something sort of topological about this Wilson line. Yeah. Okay. Now, let me sharpen just a little bit more. Oh, come on. Seriously? Okay. There we go. Some activation energy there. So let me say a little more concretely why this is now clearly a UV-sensitive question. Is, you know, the problem here is that if we try and factorize the Hilbert space, we lose the Wilson line. But there's something that's a whole lot like the Wilson line that we don't lose. So that is an operator which I'll call W prime, which I'll define as phi left dagger L, phi right L plus 1. So graphically, that's like that operator. So this operator has all the same quantum numbers as the Wilson line, and its algebra with anything that's not sitting right here is the same as the Wilson line. And in fact, I claim that this operator inserted into low energy correlation functions is identical to the Wilson line up to an overall factor of proportion, an overall proportionality factor. Now, there's a nice way of saying that. We can formalize this as a kind of operator product expansion. We have these two charge fields here that we're bringing together. And the idea is that in the limit of small separation, they're dominated by just inserting this last piece of the Wilson line. You can prove that a little bit more. You can say that in a more gauge invariant manner by looking at the string operator, where you have the two charges connected by the Wilson line. So that's now gauge invariant. And then you want to say that as you bring these guys together, it just becomes the identity operator divided by some divergent factor having to do with the two-point function of the charges. It's some kind of string operator product expansion. And it's some, you know, you can make general arguments for it when there are conformal field theories. You know, you draw a circle here and insert a complete set of states. And you can also just check it in perturbation theory by doing Feynman diagrams, but I won't bore you with that. Trust me, it works. Okay. So now, I guess, hopefully, you're starting to see what the proposal is for how to represent the Wilson line in ADS-CFT. In fact, it's similar to what John was saying before. So here's the thermal field double. And then the idea is that rather than putting the Wilson line, we do this. And now what we've gained from that is that this operator is actually an operator I know how to represent in the right CFT, and this operator is actually an operator that I know how to represent in the left CFT.
Sorry, just to come back to the example here, if you had W prime,
yeah,
and if you said that was the same as the Wilson line, you would have said, I'm okay with factorization.
Yeah, but it's not the same. In the UV, it's clearly not the same. For example, W prime commutes with the electric field on the middle link, but W doesn't. So the claim is that in certain states, they're equivalent. If you like, it's a renormalization group argument. It's saying that if I take this this line operator and I evolve with the renormalization group, it flows to this operator. Yeah, that's right. They're not equivalent. They're not equivalent as operators on the entire Hilbert space. They're equivalent on low energy states, which I guess is a theme that we've been hearing a lot this week also. Now, I want to make two comments about this, right? Well, really three, but one I already made. But just to emphasize again, this is really a UV issue. Okay. Indeed, I want to emphasize that, in fact, so with these charges here, their masses could be quite large, okay? So say that we have a situation where, there's some charge field, say, at the gut scale. And say that I'm a low-energy physicist floating around in the bulk here, and I want to do some experiment involving this Wilson line. So this Wilson line is a low-energy operator. It just has to do with low energy, it's an operator in the low-energy effective theory of the gauge field coupled to gravity. And indeed, if I'm just doing effective field theory, I don't need to talk about the charges at all. I can just use the Wilson line, and everything is good. But now say that I want to represent my calculation in the CFT. I happen to know about ADS-CFT, and I want to describe my experiment using ADS-CFT. Well, the funny thing is then I need to know about these charges, even though they're extremely heavy. Even though I'm just doing a low-energy experiment, nowhere near the gut scale, I have to know about gut scale charges, or I'm never going to be able to represent the calculation in the CFT. So if you like, this is a violation of something which is called effective conformal field theory. Which is the idea that if you're doing low-energy effective field theory in the bulk, you just need to know about the spectrum of low-dimension operators in the conformal field theory. Here I'm saying no. Even if you want to do a low-energy experiment, there are rather high-dimension operators you need to know about. Okay. So again, this is another illustration of this sort of UV sensitivity of the question of how you cut the Wilson line. Now, the other comment I wanted to make, though, which is, have we really solved the problem here? Have we really? I mean, here's what we've really accomplished. You give me a correlation function in the bulk that you want to measure involving the Wilson line that goes across. And then I look at the correlation function you give me, and I say, I've got an operator for you, and here it is. And then if you use it, you'll be fine. But now you'll say, oh, no, wait a minute. I changed my mind. Actually, now I want to put an operator here. I changed my mind. Now I want to include that operator, too. Well, now you catch me. You find out I was lying. You figure out that the operator I gave you wasn't really the Wilson line. And of course, now I can just bring them even closer together. And now I can fix up that correlation function. But of course, then you can just change your mind again and say, oh, now I've got another correlation function that I'm interested in. Whereas if we're really going to be saying that I'm actually giving you the Wilson line as an operator, I should give you an operator that behaves like the Wilson line in every situation where the Wilson line makes sense. Okay, that's what it would really mean to reconstruct the Wilson line. So that means I haven't succeeded with what I said so far. Now, there's two ways I can try and deal with this. The first way is I can just preemptively bring these guys all the way to within some distance of order the Planck scale. And now if we play this cat and mouse game, well, you're going to have to ask some sort of Planck scale question in order to catch me lying, and then who knows what's going on. So by doing that, I can just postpone the problem into the regime of sort of incomprehensibility. And then I guess on some level that's progress, right? On the other hand, for me, that's not personally very satisfying progress in the sense that I still don't know what's going on. So the alternative, which I'm going to spend the rest of the talk exploring, is to think that instead what happens is that as I bring the charges together, at some point there will be a scale below the Planck scale beyond which the physics is no longer described by Maxwell. okay? And that, and it's described by some other kind of physics where there's no longer a factorization problem. And you might call that having the gauge field be emergent. Now, of course, the first one is also the gauge field being emergent, but this is having the gauge field be sort of comprehensively emergent. Now, that's still a little bit vague. So what I'm going to spend most of the rest of the time doing is giving you a very explicit example of that, where it'll show more clearly what I have in mind and how everything is working. So the example I'm going to discuss is the CPN minus one sigma model in d dimensions, d space-time dimensions. Just to be clear, this is going to be a toy model for the bulk physics, okay? Not for the CFT. We're going to be using this as a model of the bulk. Usually it's studied in two dimensions, but for us it's very useful to study it in greater than two dimensions because gravity is kind of boring in two dimensions. Okay, so the basic idea of this model, the degrees of freedom, are we have a set of complex scalar fields. We have n complex scalar fields, call them ZA, but they obey a constraint, which is that sum on A, ZA star ZA, which I'll define to be Z dagger Z, is 1. Moreover, the Lagrangian, which I'll write down in a second, is going to have a gauge symmetry, Z prime A equals e to the I theta of x ZA. Now you might say, I promised you there was going to be an emergent gauge symmetry, and look, I put in a gauge symmetry. But I claim this is okay in the sense that this is a gauge symmetry which is very easy to ungauge because it's totally local. So the constraints of this theory are ultra-local. There are no derivatives involved. Z dagger Z is 1. If we think in the Hamiltonian formalism, Z pi plus Z dagger pi dagger is 0. Z dagger pi minus pi dagger Z is 0. That's the Gauss constraint corresponding to this. So you know, if you do some sort of Dirac quantization or something, you fix the gauge. You can fix the gauge in a way that preserves manifest locality. Indeed, if you put this on the lattice, then what this implies is that each site just has a CPN minus 1 living on it. And the Hilbert space is just a tensor product of a CPN minus 1 sitting at each point in space. So in that sense, there's no factorization problem in this theory whatsoever. The Hilbert. Yeah, that's true. So this is a nonlinear sigma model, and you can complete it into a linear sigma model of matrices that where there's spontaneous symmetry breaking. But it's not. I don't think it's useful to do that here. Yeah, yeah. This is like pions or something, right? Okay. So the interesting thing about this model, though, is that despite the fact that the Hilbert space factorizes, it has emergent gauge fields at low energies. And in fact, at low energies, this theory is just the theory that we were discussing up there. It's QED coupled to charge scalars. I should tell you the Lagrangian, though, before I make more statements about it. So the Lagrangian is minus n over g squared d mu z dagger d mu z, where d mu is a covariant derivative, d mu minus I a mu, and a mu is written in terms of z. Okay. To see that this theory is a gauge theory, a real gauge theory at low energies, you have to solve it, which fortunately at large n you can do. I'm not going to discuss that in complete detail, just because, I mean, it's simple. You know, it's a vector model, really. I just don't want to take the 10 minutes it would take to explain the solution. So let me just say in words what you do. So the idea is you introduce a Lagrange multiplier field, sigma, that imposes the constraint z dagger z equals 1. And then you reintroduce a dynamical gauge field, a mu, in the sense that you just take the a mu here and you call it an auxiliary field. So it's an auxiliary gauge field. So you have a Lagrange multiplier sigma, and you have an auxiliary gauge field a mu. And then at large n, you can integrate out the z fields and generate an effective action for a mu and sigma, which is exact in the large n approximation. And then from that effective action, you can just read off the low energy dynamics. The important thing is that, how shall I say this? So the main important thing is that when you do that, you generate a Maxwell term for the auxiliary gauge field a mu. And the Zs stick around as massive charged particles. So the low energy of this theory is you have n charged particles, which are the Zs. They end up being massive because the Lagrange multiplier is sigma z dagger z minus 1, and sigma gets a vev. So there's a mass term for the Zs. The gauge field becomes propagating. So there are Coulomb interactions between the AMUs. When you look at the effective action, the coefficient of the Maxwell term that you get depends on dimension. So I'll just write them all. So there's a n over 6 pi m squared, where m squared is the mass which is dynamically generated for the sigmas, for the z's. So that's in d equals 2. In d equals 3, you get n over 12 pi times m. In d equals 4, you get n over 12 pi squared log of the cutoff over m. And then finally, for d greater than 4, you just get something that scales like n times the cutoff to the d minus 4. So this is for d greater than 4. Okay. I'm happy to discuss offline if you want to know more about where do these expressions come from. You can collect this. There's a nice way of thinking about this. So in terms of a phase diagram, so let me draw the phase diagram, just because it's rare for me to get to draw the phase diagram of a lattice theory. Here's a phase diagram for this model. So what I'm going to do to fatten out the phase diagram is, so I'll have the coupling 1 over g squared here. That's the g that appears in the Lagrangian there. And then I'm also going to allow myself to include a bare Maxwell term in terms of the auxiliary field A. So that'll be zero in the actual model that I'm interested in, but I'll allow it to be non-zero just to discuss the diagram in more detail. So here's what happens. So at very weak coupling, very small g, this is a weakly coupled sigma model. So for greater than 2 dimensions, it's like pions. So then what happens is the SUN symmetry that permutes the z spontaneously breaks. And the low energy physics is described by Goldstone bosons. There aren't any photons. That's what happens up in this corner here, and it's actually what happens everywhere up here. At some point, there's a phase transition. There's a CFT, so there's a critical value of g. The phase boundary stretches across this diagram. So up here, you have the SU2 is broken, and the U1 is Higgsed. The U1 gauge field is Higgsed, and you just have Goldstone bosons. Below this, there's a boundary like that, where here you have SUN unbroken. That's the n-charged particles. And you have U1 in a Coulomb phase. And then down here, it's confining. Okay. So the situation I'm interested in is where we approach the fixed point from below here. So I can tune that the masses of the Zs are small compared to the cutoff. And then I get a nice big Coulomb phase. Okay. Now, to get back to the point of this talk, though, what are we really interested in? What we're really interested in is to see how the low-energy Wilson line emerges from this theory. Okay? Because this was a theory that factorized at the microscopic scale. So how are we going to get the Wilson line out of it? So it's actually an easy question to answer. We just need to discretize this equation here, right? Because this is the equation that tells us how to get the gauge field in terms of the z's. So the lattice version of that equation is easy. You just say that u, let's say on the link that starts at x and then goes in direction delta, so delta hat will be some normal vector and some lattice displacement vector. So the gauge field link, the gauge field on that link, is z dagger x, zx plus delta. So now each site has a z living on it, has n complex scalars living on it, s, what we discussed previously in QED. And then it needs to be a phase, so I need to divide by the norm of that. Okay. So you can check that if you discretize this, it reproduces that. And it's also obvious that this has the right gauge transformation to be a link variable, right? Because there's a, one end of the link rotates with one phase, and the other end of the link rotates with the other phase. But what does this really mean, right? So this is how to make the link on a single variable. So now say I've got this whole Wilson line, and then I want to know what's going on right here at the link where I'm imagining doing the cut. Well, we see we can just cut it right there, right? We can cut it right there. So indeed, what it's doing is it's exactly doing this. It's saying that this OPE equation, which was approximate in the previous case, is now exact at the lattice scale. It's saying that the Wilson line literally is just this times that. Now, not quite, because you have to sum over indices to make it an SUN singlet. But other than that, it's just the thing that we were writing before. So now we see that is the microscopic theory of what's happening in this model. That's how it's able to factorize, despite the fact it has a Wilson line. Good, doing good on time here, actually. Okay, now good. So now let's I forgot to declare victory on one of my conjectures. So let me do that now. So conjecture one said there have to be charges. We already got that. Conjecture two said there have to be all charges allowed by charge quantization. Well, remember that Wilson lines can come in any representation. There can be a Wilson line in any representation of the gauge group. And in particular, if I have a Wilson line in the fundamental representation, then to be able to cut it by a charge, I need to have a charge in the fundamental representation. Okay, so that's conjecture number two. Yeah?
Before you go on, so the reason you said what you had before was not the Wilson line is because there was an operator that didn't match that same one.
Yeah.
The actual Wilson line. So you're saying there's no such thing?
Well, yeah, so good. So what happens in this model is that at energies that are small compared to the masses of the z's, it's described by electrodynamics. But as you get to energies above that, the effective action starts changing because the Maxwell term is generated by integrating out the z's. And when you get up to the lattice scale, the Maxwell term is gone. There's no bare Maxwell term in the action. So the thing that previously caused us trouble was the electric field here.
And you say that's just gone.
It's just gone. Yeah, it's gone. I mean, at this point, at this such high energy scales, the operator content of the theory is just different. It's more naturally described in terms of the z's. Yeah.
And then back to the field, what you drew there, you might have also, instead of using L and L plus 1, you might have said L and L.
Oh.
Okay, so it's singular, but you need some renormalization, et cetera, but that might still
I don't want to say that in the gravitational case, right? Because in the gravitational case, there's a Planck scale. So, you know, right, No, but I mean, even when I'm discussing this in the presence of gravity, then there's a Planck scale, and then I don't want to put them right on top of each other. Yeah. Okay, good. So now let's go back to the weak gravity conjecture. So,
In four dimensionals, what we mean by all charges is the ones that satisfy our conjecture.
Yeah.
Which includes not just the vector, but the vector.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think you should care about treating quickly the pattern of the lattice.
Okay, yeah, that's a fair comment. So, of course, in this theory, I think there are actually magnetic charges too, but they those can be heavier, right? So the weak gravity conjecture for the magnetic, the thing is because I'm assuming the coupling is weak, right? So the magnetic charges will be strongly coupled, and they'll be quite heavy. So yeah, they're there, but I think you can probably argue for them too, but it takes a little bit more work. Yeah. In particular, though, you do need to be able to cut the Itauf line. So, yeah. All right. So on to the weak gravity conjecture. So we did one and two, now we got to do three. So remember, the weak gravity conjecture said that m squared is less than or equal to q squared over g. Now, from the point of view of low energy effective field theory, each of these is a parameter. And so there's no reason why this should be true in general. In particular, if you gave me a low energy effective field theory that obeyed this inequality, I could just add to it a gigantic Maxwell term, a huge Maxwell term, as big as I want, which would make the gauge coupling as small as I want, and then we would violate the inequality. Okay. But in the CPN model, these things are computable in terms of the microscopic parameters. I don't get to tune them. They are what they are. So we can check, is this true in the CPN model? Now, to do that, we, of course, have to deal with the issue that the CPN model is a quantum field theory, whereas G is gravity, right? So what I'm imagining here is that we have the CPN model weakly coupled to gravity. And now, so we saw in dimension higher than 2, certainly higher than 3, that the cutoff is explicitly involved in the formulas here. And so the idea will be that that cutoff can't be higher than the Planck scale. That's the only thing I'm going to use about gravity. Now, I have to say, though, that when I say the Planck scale, there's an issue because there are n species around, and n is large. So we have to define carefully what we mean by the Planck scale. And indeed, the relationship between the Newton constant, meaning the thing that's measured, as the force between test masses at large distances, is related to the cutoff, meaning the scale where the gravitational perturbation series breaks down by a factor of n. So in d dimensions, this goes like n times lambda to the d minus 2, where lambda is the strong coupling scale of gravity. Computing this is essentially the same calculation here. The n comes from the same thing. So 1 over q squared is a lot like g. The only reason the powers are different is because the gravitational interactions have more powers of momentum in the numerator, so they shift, the diagrams become more divergent. Okay, but now remember in the CPN model, so I'll just discuss it for d greater than 4, but the argument works in any choice. So that we see that q squared is like 1 over n times lambda to the 4 minus d, right? That's the bottom line over there. So we can combine them, right? So let's write out what this equation says, now substituting these things in on the right-hand side. Well, that's pretty easy. This just implies that m squared is less than or equal to lambda squared. So as long as we arrange for the masses of the z's to be less than the short distance cutoff on the theory, we get the weak gravity conjecture for free. And I should emphasize that we need to do this, because if we're trying to rely on this to solve the factorization problem, the whole point was to solve the factorization problem at a scale which is less than the Planck scale. Okay, so we need to have this. So if we solve the factorization problem at a scale less than the Planck scale, the weak gravity conjecture is obeyed. No, you are absolutely not. For example, this is like a scheme-dependent factor here. So indeed, I'm not trying to get the factors of order 1 at all in this talk. Yeah, which is embarrassing, but what can I say? What? That's correct. That's right. Yeah, I checked. Okay. Now, of course, you can just say this is just what happened in this stupid model. Who cares? Okay. So let me try and say what happened in this model in a way that's a little more general, that I hope will convince you that what happens in other models shouldn't be too different. So what really happened here? The thing is that in order to solve the factorization problem, we needed the coefficient of the Maxwell term in the effective action at the cutoff scale to be small, 0 actually. Okay, that was how we solved the factorization problem. But we wanted to have weakly coupled electromagnetism in the IR, so we had to generate a big Maxwell term. Now, say that the charges were heavy. Say that the charges had masses of order the cutoff. Well, they would run in the loop for a little while, and then they would just stop, right? Because remember, well, I guess I should have drawn the diagram. The way you compute this is you compute this diagram, actually plus this diagram, with the z's running in the loop. But clearly, if the z's are heavy, if the masses are of order the cutoff, these diagrams aren't going to be any good. They're not going to generate any Maxwell term worth speaking of. So indeed, we've exactly learned that if we want the gauge coupling to be weak, we need the charges to be light, and that's what this says. Okay. So maybe said differently, right? The way to motivate the weak gravity conjecture is to argue that you're not allowed to add a huge bare Maxwell term to the action. And I've done that here using the factorization problem. All right. So the last thing I wanted to do was comment a bit on the gravitational analog of this question. So gravity is also a gauge theory. It also has derivatives in the constraints, the same as electromagnetism. And so it also has its own personal version of the factorization problem, because the two CFTs factorize into H left and H right. And somehow that has to be consistent with the Hamiltonian constraint sitting there at the bifurcation surface in the bulk. Now, the first complaint that you should make is, what do you mean by the bifurcation surface? Gravity is dynamical. We could be talking about geometries other than the thermal field double. If you're doing that, then you know where are we even talking about this split happening? So of course, that's a good question. I can't derive the answer for that for you. But there's an obvious choice that essentially, if anything like this works, must be the case. So the idea is that, you know, so let's consider one of these more, you know, one of these things that Douglas likes to talk about, or I guess likes to talk about at some point, you know, where you have a wormhole like that, which is longer. So the only place where you could imagine the factorization splitting the bulk, where this could possibly work, is the extremal surface sitting here in the center, that's homologous to either of the boundaries. And the reason is because, well, I don't even need to talk about the I don't even need to talk about the metric. Just if I want to get this Wilson line, and I want to say that I'm allowed to do this, well, if I'm going to be able to argue that I can put this operator in the right CFT and this operator in the left CFT, then I have to be doing entanglement wedge reconstruction. Clearly, causal wedge reconstruction is not good enough. That would only let me put the operators here and here, and that would be no good. So I need the entanglement wedge reconstruction to be true, and B, I then need it to be the case that I can view the cut as happening here at the extremal surface. There's another way of motivating that, but I think maybe that's the best way of motivating it. So I claim we should think of the split as happening at the extremal surface. If this is true, then I think it's interesting because it suggests maybe a deep connection between the factorization problem and the covariant version of the Ruta-Kanagi formula.
Be clear.
Yeah.
The Wilson line is still split into
the charge. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
This might be a pretty naive question, but I'm a little confused about that construction procedure.
Yeah.
That if you start with the thermal field double state and your two Wilson lines, sorry, your two lines ending at the normal bifurcation surface.
Yeah.
And then you build a long wormhole.
Yeah.
By just acting on the left CFT.
Yeah.
Then it grows. It seems like it would grow to the left.
Yeah.
I don't care where
the extremal surface is. The only thing I needed for this argument is that it's unique, so that it's the same one from both sides. Now, probably if Veronica were here, she would give me some example where it's not. And then I guess I just have to say that I think those are like bags of gold and I don't believe in them.
So it's not unique?
Well, if there was somehow more than one extremal surface somehow. I mean, somehow you should take the minimum one, right? Yeah, you take the minimal one, and then it should be unique, right? The minimal.
Does the minimal have two that are
Yeah, exactly. You could have two that are degenerate, but that's silly. Yeah, it's a fine-tuned case, and I don't know. I have to consult my lawyer before I get back to you on that one.
What if you have a three-engine blend hole where the entanglement width of any one region is like,
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I mean, somehow the factorization problem gets even more complicated because now there are three factors. So, I mean, I guess I'd first want to think about doing the electromagnetic version there, but indeed, yeah, again, I have to consult my lawyer. I don't.
Why would you think it's different? I mean, can't you make can't you have a similar picture?
I guess.
The Wilson line at the gauge symmetries emerging.
I think that's right. It's just, I guess I don't necessarily have an obvious sense of where the cut should be happening. Maybe there's still some sort of natural place for it to happen. I just haven't thought about that very much. Yeah, that's right. But maybe so there would be some quantum error correction or something involved, right? Because if you get any two of them, then you can somehow do it. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe I have to fuse this more with quantum error correction to deal with that.
The location of the cut depends on the Wilson line. Which Wilson line would consider? Which operator?
Maybe, I don't know. I guess here it didn't. Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
An algebra of bulk operators on one side of some cut, an algebra of bulk operators on the other side of the cut. And I don't see what it's all about.
No, I don't think you. No, you're good. So the reason why. So I didn't try. So colloquially, I think you can state the factorization problem as the bulk algebra seems to factorize and the CFT one doesn't. But that's not. The other way, yeah. But that's not the official statement of the problem exactly because of this.
So what's the problem?
So the official statement of the problem is just how do you represent the Wilson line in the CFTs? You can't do it in the obvious way using the current, so you have to think of something else.
Yes.
I think that's the better definition of the factorization problem. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So it's just, all I can say is that there's this puzzle of how to represent it, and this is a way to represent it. I tried to not make the argument that way exactly because I didn't want to have to commit to what happens in generic states of the two-sided system. Let me make two more comments and then I'll be done. So since Don and Aaron are both here, I have to make this comment. So. Yeah, these crazy people, they wrote this paper where they said that ADS is not equal to CFT because you need extra degrees of freedom that tell you whether or not the two sides are connected. When I first was thinking about this problem, I considered the possibility that those are the things you need to write down the Wilson line. Those superselection sectors. And it's not crazy, right? Because the Wilson line only exists if the two sides are connected. If they're not connected, it doesn't exist. And in fact, I should emphasize more generally that the description of this, you know, really is somehow a fundamental part of how the bridge forms, does the bridge form, this kind of thing. Even more so for the gravitational case, because the gravitational version of these guys really is the thing that tells you how the geometry you get this way is sewed together with the geometry that you get by going that way. So understanding the representation of these guys is somehow crucial for understanding this question of when and how the bridge emerges. I thought, well, maybe since it's not there in the case, if there's a case where there's no bridge, then it's not there, then maybe somehow it's making use of the superselection sectors. However, I found a way of doing it that doesn't need the superselection sectors. So if you grant me that I'll also find such a way of doing that for the gravitational case, then who needs superselection sectors? What I would say is that what the ADS-CFT correspondence does is it gives a UV completion of gravity in the bulk where it's the right kind such that you don't have a choice about whether the bridge forms or not. The Wilson line is there automatically. It's there just from the structure of the theory, and you can't avoid it. So That's right. So I happily acknowledge that, I happily concede that until I solve the gravitational problem, I can't really skewer you with this argument. But the fact that I was able to solve it in the electromagnetic case increases my prior that I'll be able to solve it for the gravitational case, and thus decreases my prior that there are super selection sectors. That's the comment.
You also proved that ADS-CFT actually works this
way. Yeah, that's right. Right. But but at least it could. Yeah. And I think, you know, the fact that this argument makes contact with things that we like anyway for other reasons in string theory makes it more likely that it does work this way. So this was just super selection sectors bad. I guess that could be Shankar Stanford, but no, that's still okay. okay. So finally, the last comment. So this will be about bulk reconstruction of operators behind the horizon. So what talk would be complete without some discussion of that? So say I have some operator. So say I want to describe some experiment where I jump in up here and I do some measurement behind the horizon. So since that experiment entirely involves equipment which is on this side, we should think of the gravitational dressing as going this way. Okay. Now I drew it as a gravitational Wilson line, but you know, it's probably something for an actual experiment, it'll be something more complicated than that. But nonetheless, I think it should be true that all of the dressing should be going this way. Now, let's say we want to describe that by just evolving the apparatus back to t equals zero and describing it in terms of operators on this time slice. Now, it's clearly going to have to make use of operators over here. Okay? Clearly, there's obviously stuff here that doesn't commute with that. Right, you can just, you know, you can throw a potato or something, okay? But given that it's dressed this way and that we evolve back like this, it does have to commute with everything over here, including the boundary Hamiltonian, you know, the boundary charge, you know, all of the asymptotic charges at the boundary here, which means that whatever operators I'm using here, I'm going to have to dress them this way, okay? Yeah, because all of its dressing goes this way. Yeah.
Just because something is dressed one direction doesn't mean it doesn't depend on other
directions. Well, there's something down here it certainly doesn't commute with, but I mean something here.
Oh, you don't mean that in the general sense of every operator.
No, not every operator in the CFT. No, yeah, let's just restrict to the asymptotic charges. It has to commute with the asymptotic charges here. Okay? Yeah, that's all I need to make this argument. So then I think, although I can't, I'm not sure I have totally rigorously established that, but I think that means that these guys here, which I need to use to make it, all have to be dressed this way. Okay? So what that means, remember though that the operators I can describe here naturally are dressed that way. Those are the ones that I can write using the usual HKLL type rules. So if I want to make one that's dressed this way, I need to use the dressing switching operator, which is, of course, exactly this Wilson line. So for the electromagnetic case, it's this Wilson line. For the gravitational case, it's the gravitational analog of the Wilson line. So upshot is, to describe this guy here, we need to solve the factorization problem, okay, for gravity as well, at least if we're going to try and do the reconstruction but in this type of manner. So that's interesting because, remember, we argued that representing the Wilson line, or presumably representing the gravitational Wilson line, in the CFTs is a UV-sensitive question. We weren't able to do it just using the current, presumably, well, just using the stress tensor for the gravitational case. We need to know something about, you know, the heavy charges, or in the gravitational case, probably something to do with the microstates of what's going on here, in order to produce this operator, at least if we're going to produce it using anything along the lines of what I discussed today. So if that's true, and I think it is, then this implies that bulk stuff behind the horizon is UV sensitive, at least in terms of how we describe it in the CFTs. And I think that's interesting. I mean, I think, actually, I find it somewhat refreshing. I'm getting kind of tired of how far we can get just knowing the low-energy Lagrangian and not having to solve any hard problems. I personally am embarrassed, actually, that I've been working on this problem for years, and I've never had to use any UV information from string theory. Here we are using one, this whole talk is based on one piece of UV information. And the one piece is that the Hilbert space factorizes into the left and right. That tells us that the UV cutoff of the bulk provided by ADS-CFT can't be like the UV cutoff provided by lattice gauge theory, because that one didn't factorize. It has to be more like the one provided by the CPN model. Now, of course, that doesn't mean it is the CPN model, but it has to be more like that. That's telling us UV-specific information here, and we're going to need to know that information to reconstruct this operator. All right, I think I'm done. Thanks. Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, and I said at the beginning, I'm assuming ADS-CFT, you know, and in this context, that means, you know, I'm assuming that the thermal field double state, you know, as a state of two copies of the CFT describes this geometry.
But that's a logical alternative.
That's correct, yes. And that's the sense in which this argument, so good. So let me actually put an exclamation mark on that. So in many of these pieces of lore about constraints on low energy effective field theory from quantum gravity, there's a way of saying it that doesn't involve assumptions about short distance physics. So a good example of this is that you can't have continuous global symmetries. There's an argument for that just based on black hole evaporation. It doesn't involve, that it happened. I mean, it is true in string theory, but we don't need to use that to make the argument, okay? Now here, I had to use ADS-CFT. So in that sense, this argument is somehow worse than the argument against continuous global symmetries. Now, I guess, you know, emotionally, I feel it's better than just saying, oh, it's true in every compactification we've found so far, which is kind of the previous kinds of arguments for the weak gravity conjecture and so on. But, I mean, it's still using ADS-CFT, and maybe that's wrong. Yeah?
Is there a subtlety in defining the switching operator in the gravitational case, especially considering there is no negative charge?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think the answer is no, roughly. There's an interesting question, right? How did Einstein know that he needed to discover general relativity instead of just having Maxwell theory be the generalization of gravity, right? It was because of the sign that opposite masses attract, but opposite charges repel. And so I think that sign means that you can resolve the factorization problem in gravity without needing negative mass. But I'm actually not sure. This is something I want to work on.
Can you explicitly write down using low-energy gravity switching operator?
I think you should be able to, but I haven't managed to do it. That was something I was hoping to discuss with some of the experts here. Yeah, I was postponing this paper for a while trying to do it. Will, for example, was probably, or Don, or... what is that? What is that? I mean, it's not just e to the I times, right? So in a gauge, I know what it is, right? If we work in holographic gauge, you know, then I can, right? I can define it as the operator where I shoot a geodesic, right? But that's not actually a representation of the operator in terms as a functional on phase space, right? I mean, whereas with the Wilson line, I can give it.
Explicit.
Yeah, it's not explicit.
Well,
yeah.
Sorry, we have the Wilson line operator in another context, as you know, in the flat context. So which one do you?
Well, I don't think you have it as a gauge invariant function on phase space.
Non-perturbative.
Yeah. Well, or even perturbatively. I mean, I know how to compute things with it by going to holographic gauge, but did you write down the formula? Okay. That's good. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I know what its canonical conjugate is. Actually, maybe that's something that's worth emphasizing, is that, you know, the canonical conjugate of the... So the real meat is the Wilson link here, and its canonical conjugate is the electric field. So the canonical conjugate for the gravitational one is the area of the extremal surface. That's the Noether charge sitting here. And so that's another reason why I think there's a connection with Rutaki-Nagi. But yeah, it would be nice. I thought it was supposed to have something to do with something called the opening angle, but I have not yet managed to understand what that is. I guess these guys know about it. But isn't the opening angle supposed to be conjugate to the area? Yeah, but that's a Euclidean thing. So then I was trying to figure out how to make it Lorentzian. I believe you, but is it the same as what he said? Okay, I mean, I believe you. Please explain it to me.
Maybe just see if there are any final questions.
Well, I should just ask you. 7 minutes ago, you solved this for the case, and you said, well, all I do is solve it for Bradley, which would have the same. But isn't that kind of scenario, isn't the gravitational analog of that kind of scenario?
Good. Yeah. Exactly. So I will not be able to write down an analog of the CPN model for gravity. That's right. I will not, unless I somehow construct loop quantum gravity or bulk quantum gravity or something. Right. So indeed, that's why I didn't do it. That's right. So it's clearly not going to be some sort of local, local lattice theory or something in some trivial way. But nonetheless, I still feel like, for example, by understanding the kinds of things you guys are saying, that there's probably more to say about it than what I said so far. I don't know. Maybe it's like the, I swear I would never use this word, but maybe it's like the fuzzballs or something.